now here they are, and they are fighting for the House. They're fighting for the Senate. They're fighting for the last one third of state houses throughout the country. And they are also fighting for the Supreme Court, and they're fighting for the White House. They are not all aligned on everything. Not all of their elected officials represent everything that they care about. But because they have come together with a clear goal, we are now seeing the impacts of their level of organization. We're seeing the impacts of their ability to build the kind of infrastructure that is needed to take the power that they want. And so I think for us moving forward, there are some questions laying in front of us. Certainly, I've been disappointed by positions that Joe Biden has taken on. And he was not my first choice, my second choice, my third choice, and not even really my eighth choice. But here we are. The contest is now between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and Donald Trump and Mike Pence. But much bigger than that, the contest is about whether or not we are able to have free and fair elections in this country. And this contest is about what is going to be the future of this country. And frankly, that doesn't just play out at the ballot box.
10
that
seconds.
Is going to be played out by movements. And so that is why this book is so important. It helps give us tips and tools about how to build the kinds of movements that can last and that can win.
Alicia Garza, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Principal of Black Futures Lab, co-founder of Supermajority and Black Lives Matter Global Network. Her new book, The Purpose of Power, How We Come Together When We Fall Apart. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in on Election Day, November 3rd at 6 p.m. to hear KBOO's Election Night Special. We will start the evening with a live stream of Democracy Now! At 7:30, we will be tracking national, state, and local results live, as well as hearing from community groups and your favorite KBOO programmers as we break down this historic election. Again, that's KBOO's Election Night Special starting at 6 p.m. on November 3rd at 90.7 on your FM dial or online at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Abe Proctor and Tracy Simmons. Keep it locked here on your Community Connection.
Good morning. Good morning. We are 1 week away. How you doing, Tracy?
You know, I'm hanging in here. I'm trying to sprint to the finish.
Sprint through mud that rises to your knees and is pulling you down with every step. This is Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor. Sitting across the virtual desk from me is Tracy Simmons. And we are very, very pleased to be with you this morning as we head into what will undoubtedly be one of the strangest 7 days you will ever live through.
I'm prepared. I feel good. You know, I'm trying to tamp down my existential doom and really just try and put in my optimist space of we're going to get through this. I'm really, really pleased at all the early voting numbers and seeing people standing in lines really makes my heart hurt, but also makes me think, wow, people are moving, people are out in droves. We are seeing a shift and a movement away from the complacency of not voting to I need to get my butt out here and vote because the future of this country is on the line in this election. And so I'm just trying to, you know, kind of center myself in that optimist space while all the things are happening around me.
Yeah, I'm doing very much the same. I'm real hesitant to look up and sort of read any tea leaves at all, but, you know, this is a talk radio show, so that's exactly what we're going to do. The tea leaves, give reason for, I think, cautious optimism here. And now I need to remind everybody, although I'm sure this is drilled into your brains 1,000 times over, in order for the Democratic candidate to win in this election, that win needs to be convincing enough to overcome the built-in structural advantages afforded to the incumbent, right? Not if Joe Biden's going to win, he can't just squeak by. He's got to win by a lot, not only to triumph in the Electoral College, which is, of course, the most important calculation, but also to be able to effectively rebut the inevitable charges of fraud that are going to come from the Trump camp. So this really needs to be as close to a blowout as it can possibly be. And the early indicators are hinting in that direction.
Yeah. You know, I always say, don't follow the polls. Look at the polls. Right? Like, who's out there? Who has got themselves to, you know, their local establishment, especially in places where there is early voting in person? We're seeing, unfortunately, lines that indicate voter suppression, but also people are pushing past that and getting themselves out there. And so, you know, I'm really hopeful. I know that here in Oregon, we have vote by mail, and we're already seeing outsized returns from, if you compare to the 2016 election, across the state. And it's, you know, of course, there's predictions out there that we will be at about 90% or so with returns. So I'm just trying to maintain hope, because I think that's about all I have at this point, keeping it all the way real.
Just to put some figures to what we're talking about here, according to Elect Project, a nonpartisan online vote tabulation and data collection and analysis outfit, there are about roughly a dozen states who collect party registration data in connection with their vote-by-mail systems. Oregon is among them. So far, there have been 52 million, almost 53 million ballots requested in those states. And the return rates so far indicate a pretty sizable advantage in returned ballots for those voters who registered with the Democratic Party. This is no indication of how those people will actually vote, but in terms of which registered ballots have been returned so far, that frequency distribution right now is about 52.2% in favor of the Democrats. Republicans come in at 24.7%. Again, this is only a handful of states, only those states with robust vote-by-mail programs, and only those states which collect party registration data as part of their system. So you can take that for whatever you think it's worth, but there it is.
Yeah, it's good data. You know, I just keep, you know, focusing on, you know, what are we going to do the night of? And I know you have some ideas about that. If all of these votes that are sitting somewhere and are not yet tallied are not tallied enough, and we have a conversation about, you know, well, what if there's not a clear decision election night? What do we do? And that gives me a lot of heart palpitations and tummy troubles. So what do you think, Gabe? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, there's a better than good possibility, and by better than good, I have no idea statistically what I mean. It just sounds rhetorically nice. I think there's a better than good possibility that we may go to bed next Tuesday night without knowing a clear winner of the election. There's a number of reasons for this. One is the fact that, you know, there is a global pandemic happening, and the proportion of voters voting by mail or voting with absentee or provisional ballots is much higher than we're used to. So this is going to create, naturally, some delays in the sorting and processing and counting of those votes, particularly in a number of states who have a law that says we can't even unseal our mail-in or absentee ballots until the day of the election. So some of those states I was just referencing a moment ago, you know, they've already got, you know, ballots piling up someplace, and they can't even begin to open them until election night. So that's going to take some time to count and tabulate. Now, there's some reasons that this could cause some problems, as you might imagine. Our president, you know, the dedicated scion of liberty, has indicated a number of times that he may not accept the results of the election if it looks like he's going to lose. In fact, I think we can count on him pushing back on the results if they are negative. Really, the only question is to what extent will he push back? He's already indicated that he believes the system to be inherently fraudulent. He has already signaled many, many times over that he is going to contest the results. But what might happen and what might bolster his case, at least in the minds of his supporters, is this situation we might be looking at in which we don't know who the winner is right away. And it may look because Republican voters are more likely to show up and vote in person. So their votes are going to be tabulated faster. So you may have this situation, which has been called in various circles of the media, the red mirage, which is kind of a silly term, but we're going to go with it. You may have this situation where it appears that not just the president, but other Republican candidates have sizable leads as we all go to bed on election night. And over the ensuing days and weeks, we're going to see that gap narrow as these outstanding mail-in absentee and provisional ballots are tabulated. Statistically, this would deliver the victory, at least if our predictions and many people's predictions are accurate, this would deliver the presidency to Joe Biden after some time had passed, during which all sorts of mischief is possible. All kind of mischief is possible in that interregnum period between the closing of the polls on election night and such point as we actually have a clear winner. So that's really what keeps me up at night, Tracy, is wondering what's going to happen in that sort of free-for-all period. You know, stand back and stand by, Proud Boys. Exactly.
The stuff of nightmares, for real. You know, and I, you know, we've just seen Amy Coney Barrett, who I kind of shared at least a couple months ago, that she was the candidate that Trump was looking at. As soon as Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed, she was sworn in last night. There's, I guess, another pomp and circumstance kind of procedure that will have to happen, but you know, we will have installed our ninth very unqualified justice, and I'm just going to guess that there might be some fiddling around that they'll do as well. They're already working on nullifying votes in different areas by saying that certain areas, if the votes are not in by election day, won't be counted. They're fighting against all kinds of different rules that are already heading up to the Supreme Court and being ruled on. And so I'm wondering what hand do you think this new composition of SCOTUS will play into this whole scenario, doomsday scenario that you have outlined?
Well, in the event that we face a 2000-like situation, which I think is unlikely, there really that was a confluence of very unusual circumstances that led to the situation in the year 2000. But for whatever it is that happens, if the election is somehow delivered into the hands of the Supreme Court, now you've got a 6-3 conservative majority. And our president, who never fails to say the quiet part out loud, has already indicated he selected or nominated Amy Coney Barrett so that she could help him out in that situation. Because yeah, that's what the Supreme Court is for, right?
Yeah.
To ensure the outcome of presidential elections. So tell us more about why you think she's not qualified.
Oh, I mean, there's lots of reasons. I mean, I don't know. I just think about the kinds of jobs that I am looking for or, you know, have looked for in the past. And typically, you know, they're wanting someone with a lot of experience. And when you kind of go down the list about Amy Coney Barrett, she's got 2 years in private practice, never tried a case, never argued an appeal, never argued before the Supreme Court. Most of her private work involved civil cases, not criminal cases. And she's got 15 years of teaching experience, which, you know, that's great. But she never served as a judge until 2017, where she was also, by Trump, given a stolen seat that was already, you know, in process by the Obama administration for an actual black woman who was being nominated for that state Supreme Court. And so what we find is, you know, just under qualification, I would say, not the kind of qualification that to me would indicate she'd be prepared or highly qualified for a lifetime job. Just right. Going to keep it there.
Yeah, this fits an emerging pattern because Brett Kavanaugh was appointed and confirmed to the Supreme Court without ever having tried a case in open court.
Yeah.
So apparently you really don't even have to be a practicing lawyer or even a practicing judge to meet the current round of conservative qualifications.
And I wonder, where are the minimum qualifications? You know, as I'm working, I'm always thinking about, you know, bringing in new people to the work that I do, and a lot of that is built up in the selection process. But vetting people for their experience and ability to do the job in a quality way. And so the fact that we don't have just the basic minimum qualifications for a position that has this much impact on the lives of Americans, to me, makes absolutely no sense. I mean, can I be a Supreme Court justice? You know, I've read some cases. I have some ideas about things. I mean, it's preposterous, right? It doesn't even make sense that a person so underqualified would even be considered, let alone get the job. And of course, we're skewing younger and younger. So, you know, Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett are some of the youngest people at that space, and their decisions will impact Americans for the next two or three generations at minimum. And so we really have to think about that. Like, how does this happen, and now what? Now what do we do?
Yeah, and it really amounts to a functional veto on progressive legislation that may arise out of Congress, you know, for the foreseeable future. I really think that's the big argument to be made in favor of expanding the number of seats on the court, as we've heard tossed around. There is one upside, though, I think, to Judge Coney Barrett's confirmation, and that is, you know, it's happened in late October, which is a helpful reminder for us all to set our clocks back to 1820. So I'm feeling pretty happy about that. So this is Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. We would love to hear what you're thinking at this singular moment in time. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also tweet at us at TMIPDX. Did I get that right, or did I leave something off that Twitter address?
It's TMIPDX2.
TMIPDX2. Thank you very much. So you can reach us in both of those ways. We would love to hear what's on your mind today. So I presume you voted already, Tracy, being a good Oregonian?
I have, and I typically get everyone that I know who is voting in my same area together, and I talk through what we're going to do as a strategy. And so in this case, you know, it's just me and my partner at the house now. My older daughter has moved to Tillamook, so she got a different ballot. But, of course, she called me about a couple things. But, yes, and I never mail my ballot. I will just say today is the last day to actually mail your ballot. So if you are in Oregon, please get it in the mail today, or plan to figure out where your local drop box is and make sure that you do that. But so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff on the ballot, too. I do live in Multnomah County, so there's a lot of stuff on the ballot for Multnomah County, including our mayor race in the city of Portland. I know in Gresham there's, you know, mayoral options on the ballot as well. So there's a lot at the local level that's really important that we need to be, you know, showing up for, even if we know Oregon might go blue, of course, and vote for Biden. There are so many other implications for your vote. So definitely find your drop box and get it in the mail today. But yes, I've already voted. I'm excited. I encourage my mama to already vote as well. She's got her stuff in. So we're not waiting till the last minute. And I think it's just really important in this election, as it is in every election. I was having a really interesting conversation with my mom about the first time I voted, and I voted with her, and we lived in Wisconsin, and it's the only time I've ever voted in person, and I have just become eligible to vote. But, you know, we moved to Oregon right after that, and so I've been voting by mail ever since. And thinking back, like, I just remember showing up to my school with her when I was a little kid. And it was just something she always took me to do and instilled in me as important as a part of, you know, my role in society. And so trying to do the same with my daughter. I have a 14-year-old, and she was there as we were going through the ballots and looking through the voter pamphlet, which I have questions about. But that voter pamphlet is kind of a mess. But, you know, people can just say anything in there. It's like, wait a second. Let me look on my Twitter and see what people are saying, because that doesn't seem right. But, you know, thinking about how we instill this kind of sense of responsibility in our generations to come. We've seen an outsized number of millennial and Gen Z voters who are voting in this election. And so it just gives me hope for the future that these folks will kind of show up and represent the future in ways that, you know, my mom and grandparents and others just really can't, because they're not going to be around to see what happens. They're not going to be around to, you know, reap the repercussions of not taking care of the environment and the climate. They're not going to be around to see the death of democracy, right? Like, so it's really on, you know, my generation and the generations that will come, after me, my daughter's generation, and those following, that will really, we need to get them civically engaged.
I totally agree. And, you know, you're right about it, voting being instilled as a value and as a privilege early on in life. I remember the same thing. I was talking to my mom as she went through the voter's pamphlet when I was a boy, staying up to watch election returns during presidential elections with her. And, you know, I really, sitting at the, you know, where I am now, I really appreciate not only that, but I appreciate living now in a state where, you know, the vote by mail system is just so inherently superior, I think, than voting in person. A lot of people I talk to reminisce about voting in person, about how they would go to their polling place and they would talk to their fellow citizens about voting, and it would be sort of a social affair. And I get that. But I would trade that in a heartbeat for the increased turnout that vote by mail gives us, and the fact that you're able to vote. Like this year, my wife and stepdaughter and I opened a bottle of wine, sat at the dining table, and went back to the pamphlet and voted. And that is the way to vote. Let me tell you.
Exactly. You have more time.
That's how it should be done.
To do the research. Yes. I think when you are in, you know, that little tiny little stall, there's some kind of mental pressure on you to hurry up and get it done and move out of the way for the person that's standing in line behind you. And so if you haven't already plotted out what you're going to do when you get there, or you haven't researched every possible choice that you have, you kind of make those rash and rush decisions. And I think the vote-by-mail system that we have in Oregon is something that we absolutely need to give voice to when we're talking to people from other places, and encourage them to demand this of their legislatures, that we need to move in this direction. The rampant voter suppression that we're seeing right now and voter subtraction is a threat. It's a threat to our democracy. It's a threat to, you know, free and fair elections in the future. And so I think the answer is having strong and accurate options like vote by mail.
Yeah, I agree. And as Engineer Sonia just pointed out, in Oregon, the Secretary of State's office has taken steps to aid houseless people who still want to exercise their right to vote. I realize if you're houseless, your chances of being able to get on the internet are somewhat reduced, but if you are able, you can go to sos.oregon.gov and you can learn how to cast your vote, even if you do not have a home. So I'm really grateful that people in power are working to facilitate the right of homeless people to exercise their franchise. That's incredibly important. Let's go to the phones. We've got Cassandra this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mine.
I like what you just said about, well, I mean, it's not new, but the idea that our voices need to be heard, and our voices, the only way that the common person today who is not affiliated with organizations, what have you, can have their voice heard is through their vote. Whether we believe our vote actually counts or not, whether or not the system is completely broken, which it is, is irrelevant. It's the only power we still possess, and we need to use it. And
yes.
A thought has been running through my brain for the last couple of days, and I just want to pass this on. It's a saying by Kurt Vonnegut, paraphrasing because I don't have the exact in front of me. Basically, careful what you pretend to be, because in the end, it's what you are. So when you use that voice, make sure it represents who you really are. And don't, you know, we are what we do. We are what we stand for. We are what we believe in, but only in so much as we follow through with it. And we need to keep that in mind more than ever. And I guess that's all I really want to say.
Thank you, Cassandra.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear what you're saying. We are who, eventually we are who we tend to be. And you should make sure that your vote represents who you are. But that, as a progressive, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels this way, I feel caught in a bind there. Because to exercise my vote to represent who I really am, you know, well, here in Oregon, it's probably more or less a safe move. But depending on where you are in the country, doing that might mean that you, the wrong person ends up winning the election. It's hard to swallow. But sometimes as an American progressive, you have to triangulate with your vote. And it's incredibly frustrating. But there it is. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, you know, spot on. And I think, you know, when we talk a lot about, you know, voting your interest, not voting the interest of corporations and you know, white supremacists and other kinds of interests that we know are on the ballot right now, I think it's really important to get centered in what is your future? What do you want your future to be like? What would you want the future to look like for your children and grandchildren? And vote with that interest in mind. You know, I had an interesting conversation around the whole voting with my mom around her property taxes. In Multnomah County, they're just so high, and she was worried about voting for some of these city measures, and many of them do have tax implications. And I said, well, you know, what about my kids and their future? Like, hey, you need to vote for this. I'm eventually going to be paying for your house anyway, so make sure that you think about the future. And this is the kind of conversations where we're bringing our elders along with us and having these conversations about what they want for the future. And I think these are critical conversations.
Isn't that the very essence of participation in a representative democracy, an intergenerational conversation about what we want life to be like, measuring the way we want things to be against the way they are now and acting accordingly? I think that's exactly what should be happening. So it just warms my heart to hear you talk about that conversation with Emma. That's awesome. Okay. Let's go to Robbie. Good morning. What's on your mind?
Oh, good morning. You know, actually, I wanted to let people know they probably, you know, it's awesome that everybody's voting. You know, obviously, where I stand on the issue, which I don't want people to, you know, not vote. I just want people to realize that this is not the solution. Joe Biden was who I was protesting and, you know, getting tear gassed against back when Black Lives Matter started, you know, and Dakota Access Pipeline and Occupy Wall Street. But I want to tell people, when they're voting, it's actually important. You know, there might be, and it's actually more common on the primary elections and in special elections, but you'll see that there's uncontested elections, right? That's just like one name and then the write-in option, right? I want to tell people that it's important, unless you know that person and unless you have read that person's thing, you don't have to vote in all of the things. Your ballot can consist of one tally. If that's all you truly support. And that's what I really wish people did vote for what they believed in, because then we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in this, you know, political mess. But it's important not to vote on that one person that you don't know that's not running on there. And a lot of people will just tally it because it's the one thing there. Because if there is a grassroots movement, if there is a write-in campaign at last minute that we are unaware of, you're taking away from that momentum. So I wanted to, you know, we need to be educated when we vote, which is, I think, part of the problem that I stand in, because I'm kind of, you know, for instance, the whole Senate confirmation thing, I don't trust Democrats. There were so many tools that they could have done to prevent this appointment, and they did none of them. And it's the same exact thing when it comes to the war budget. It's the same exact thing when it comes to Nancy Pelosi doing the political game and not working with Republicans to get any stimulus package through. What I am witnessing should be disgusting to every person who calls himself a Democrat. We should not be supporting the Democratic Party. I just don't understand why we do. We fall to this identity politics. We fall to this, oh, I like the way that, you know, they sound, and it's, we're not looking at what they're doing. So it's like my frustration.
I disagree. That's not what people do. You know, people don't succumb to something that sounds nice. In many cases, they cast a vote so that the naked fascist won't get a second term. Those are two different things. Yes, the Democratic Party is incredibly unsatisfied.
I don't think I explained my point very well, but like getting appointed, right? The Democrats had at least three tools they could have done, all of which spoke loudly about who they are. For instance, let me start with the first one, the impeachment. That was a joke. There was so many things we could have impeached.
I thought we were talking about the Supreme Court nomination.
That's exactly where this is going. They could have pressed another impeachment trial. They could have tucked all the other things that they didn't impeach Trump on the first time, the emoluments clause, all these situations. They could have pressed an impeachment and stunted him from being able to appoint anything. That was one tool. The second one is that the Democrats could have it's called the quorum amominis. They could have forced the Republicans to show up, and until all 51 Republicans show up on the Senate floor, then they could vote. That's a means for disruption. They could have not have voted in this. So there's all these tools that they didn't do. And so
it's my understanding that there weren't any procedural gimmicks that they could try. They were not empowered to stop the vote.
See, they are. That's the thing. On the media, we're told that it was up to us to call our senators and try to stop this confirmation hearing. What doesn't make sense is from people. You know who's running against Nancy Pelosi? Shahad, I forget his last name. It's in San Francisco.
Buttar.
This guy was all about it. And that's the problem. There's a disconnect from the media on the surface level. What people are paying attention to is not what's actually happening there on the Hill. And so when you're listening to the people that are not being amplified on media, which KBOO gets close to, and which is why I call in so much, I'm passionate about this stuff. We're not paying attention to the facts. And the facts is that the Democratic Party is a war machine puppet. And that's really what it is. And so until we can all get up to this level that the Democrat, like, that's the problem. Tom Hartman, I was drilling him about this. I called into his show. He tried convincing me that they didn't have it, just as you said, that they could not stop it. And the fact is, it just came out right now that they could have done stuff. They didn't have to vote. If they didn't vote, it would have required all 51 Republicans to have shown up. They didn't even do that. And so when we look at this, what I see is the war machine, which is what the Democratic Party is working for. So I just want people to be a little bit more educated in their vote. I want them to understand how it works. You know, earlier on, you know, the Teresa Rayford and Sarah Ivanar, I think I pronounced her name wrong, Ted Wheeler, right? That's the mayoral thing going on. I'm writing in as a protest because Sarah Ivanar is just going to be another Ted Wheeler in less than 4 years if she even gets in. And that's because this is the political game. It's not because I think Teresa Rayford would get more stuff done. I think it's this idea of voting and watching what happens if you actually did get a candidate with progressive values in. They will never get in. That's the situation. That's the disconnect that I'm at. And so it's like, okay, how do we get beyond this? You know, if we're going to...
Okay, well, that's a conversation for another time. Robbie, I always appreciate your comments, man. You keep us on it. I appreciate that. Thank you for the call.
I think Robbie has a good point, right? That voting is the front door, right? That you vote in who you think is going to do the best job. You're not getting married. It's not a lifetime commitment. And you focus on what they actually do when they get your vote. And hold them accountable for the things that you want them to do and not do, right? And so I do agree that we have a lot more than just voting that we are responsible for. Are you showing up for your city council meetings? Are you showing up for your school board meetings? Are you even putting yourself out there to be elected into these roles to do the actual work that is needed? So I think Robbie has a point. I also think that sometimes the protest voting in places like Oregon is more reasonable, but in places like Pennsylvania, places like Texas, Florida, I don't want to see anybody writing in Kanye's name, okay? I'm just over it. I don't think it's cute. It's not funny. And because we have democracy on the line, we have to make those choices wisely.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That was well said. All right, you are listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. I want to remind everybody that we are in the midst of KBOO's fall appeal membership drive. We do depend on your contributions to keep the bells and whistles running at our station. So if you are so moved, head on over to KBOO.fm, click on the donate button, and become a member of KBOO. We do appreciate your support. My name is Dave Proctor. I'm here with Tracy Simmons. We are documenting the craziness as we head into our election 1 week from today. Let's go to Claudia. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I was calling to agree with the previous caller about the importance of accuracy from what passes for media. For instance, on this show, a couple weeks ago, you told me that Trump was a billionaire. No, he's not. He wants everybody to think so, but he's not. Then that was followed by a long disquisition on the evils of money getting into our elections, and I agree with that completely. But I do think it would have been worth mentioning that Trump was running out of money at that time. I'm not sure what his current status is. So the extent to which our, quote, media can accurately inform us allows us to make more accurate and thoughtful decisions, whether it is to start for a new Boston Tea Party or just to go out and register your vote or do both. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Claudia. I also agree. I don't think any of us know how much money Trump has because he's not shown his taxes, although he recently said he would. We don't know how much money he has. He wants you to believe that he's a billionaire. And so when we talk about him as a billionaire or a millionaire, we don't know. It's based on nobody knows the actual truth. We do have some indication that he does owe somebody $421 million, which typically if you are owing that kind of money, it is indication that you have some kind of money to be able to pay that kind of debt. And so we're just going on suppositions and the information that's out there. I don't think Trump wants anyone to really know how much money he has. But he's using this, positioning around Amy Coney Barrett as a fundraising tool for his, push to the finish in this election, which we should all be worried about because he's basically telling people who are supporters of his that if he gets another 4 years, he's going to continue doing this. And so we can look forward to another 4 years of gerrymandering, voter suppression, and getting all synced up for a permanent minority rule, which is problematic for hopefully every breathing American.
Indeed. And, you know, let's face it, this wouldn't be the first time a man has exaggerated his endowments. Let's go to Corey. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you guys doing this morning?
Fine. How are you?
Pretty good. I'll be brief. I've been listening for a couple of weeks to the people calling in, having these sort of intellectual diatribes, and it's fine. You as an American can vote anywhere, any way you want to vote. I am a black male, and I see it as a binary choice. The state kills people that look like me. Therefore, when I hear people, if you want to vote third party, that's your right, but to me, it's a binary choice, and it's good and evil. I'm literally in Washington State. My wife and I just voted. We got the word that we crossed the border in December. We're still heading up to Canada. We're excited about it. Not saying Canada's perfect, but it's a perfect situation for me and my wife. That's us. But with that being said, when I hear people who – I still have friends in Portland, friends and family, and as of this weekend, people, well, I'm voting third party. I'm like, that's your choice. Like Tracy said, I don't have time, nor can I afford to be cute. There seems to be like this sort of patty cake thing where I'm going to make a stand. Well, people like me are getting killed on the street. So, I hope everybody goes out there and vote. You know, we voted, you could assume who we voted for. We voted for Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, which is funny because Kamala Harris was just voted the most liberal senator in the Senate. Yet there are some people calling her a police officer. So I find that to be a sort of odd dichotomy. But no, I appreciate listening to you guys. I just find it odd that, like, for someone, I guess, that looks like me, I don't have time to sort of be cute, and there seem to be people who are still like on the fence with being cute, and it's sort of frustrating.
Well, hey, man, thank you as always for your comments. Really appreciate it. And thanks for voting. Yeah, when friends like that, it seems like it's a pretty easy choice. You know, I hadn't considered it, you know, a binary vote, because people who look like Corey are being killed on the street by the state. That is an imperative that myself as a white person doesn't have to consider when I cast my vote. So white people even get to vote from a position of privilege. Perhaps it is even the origin of that privilege. I don't know. Well, it's not. But yeah, that is an angle I hadn't considered in terms of casting a vote. I really appreciate that call, Corey. Let's go to BT. Good morning.
Hello, Abe and Tracy. I haven't called in a while. I just want to. I liked a couple callers ago talking about, you know, reality. Sticking to facts. There's a couple points I wanted to make. I don't particularly care for this new Supreme Court justice. She wouldn't have been my pick. And if you want to hear one superficial reason, I can't stand her voice. And the other thing is, I never trust. They're always trying to sneak in these people that for the abortion issue. I don't know if that's really going to happen. They've been trying it for years. But so far as I'm concerned, they seem outraged that, oh, it shouldn't be a federal decision. It should be left to the states. Well, that's like code for, you know, let's ban it altogether. I don't know if she's one of them, but anyway, the thing is, but there's nothing unconstitutional about this appointment. The Supreme Court, I mean, the Constitution doesn't say anything about the president can't appoint somebody in an election year or anything like that, so that's nonsense. And then what McConnell did 4 years ago, I didn't support that. It was still a majority, majority could do something. They could have actually passed a guy through and then voted him down. It probably wouldn't have happened because Republicans usually pass people like Ginsburg and others with big numbers, but it was completely legal, this thing, and to listen to someone like Schumer, the rhetoric about the dark day, what happened. Another thing is, how about this thing about Washington, D.C. statehood and Puerto Rican statehood? It's just a ploy to get four senators. Now, the way I look at it is Puerto Rico, I would have been given them a choice a long time ago, not just a vote on whether or not to become a state or remain a territory, because they get some advantages of being a territory and not a state. I would say let's have a vote, independence or statehood. Washington, D.C. is another story. There were people living in Washington, D.C., or some areas of Washington, D.C., where the people who live in that area have been voting for a long time. And we ought to do the same thing. For instance, if you look at the map, it's kind of square, but with cut off at the river. Washington, D.C. used to straddle the Potomac. Alexandria,
mm-hmm. It did.
What became the town of Arlington. Those people have been voting for well over a century. I think that Washington, D.C. should be reduced in size to get closer to the mall and all the government stuff and all those people in the huge residential areas, which were never thought were going to, you know, be so well populated, should become part of Maryland. They could probably get another House seat out of that. So giving them the vote is more important than making that little city a state, as far as I'm concerned.
But yeah, you're right. There are a bunch of prerogatives layered one atop the other here when we're talking about these two situations. It's important to note, though, that Puerto Rico, the people of Puerto Rico have on a number of occasions voted on their status as to whether or not they wanted to become a state. The most recent time was 2017, where they voted overwhelmingly to remain separate and not be a state. Now, that the people of D.C., whom I understand have for some time been wanting to become a state. By your arguing, that's less important than simply making sure that the residents of the District of Columbia are in fact enfranchised and represented in government.
Yeah, well, I'm saying, well, Puerto Rico is an island. You could look at it. It's bigger. It's as big as some small states. It's got a lot of people. It's a separate entity. Washington, D.C., it's supposed to be a district. It was never meant to have as many people as it has now. And I just think that just give those large residential areas to Maryland. They've already taken part of Washington, D.C. territory and given it to another state where the people living in that spot have now been voting for 150 years. And that's what they ought to do. It's a city. There was a New Deal Democrat type old editor of a big newspaper, advisor to Democratic presidents. I can't remember the guy's name, but he came out about 15 years ago and said the whole idea of this city thinking that it's a state reminds him of a fly landing on an elephant contemplating rape. It was, you know, come on, let's get real here.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
Oh,
thanks,
yeah.
PT.
Okay,
appreciate your call, man. Bye-bye. All right.
I will just say this. The idea that these folks don't deserve representation because they are majority people of color is telling to me. Mm-hmm. Why should they continue paying taxes, especially those people in D.C.? My sister-in-law lives in D.C., and not have a representation. It doesn't make sense. The only reason they don't have representation is because they know that would, you know, upset the balance of minority rule. And the Senate mm-hmm. right now is broken. It's not functioning the way that it should. Mitch McConnell has, you know, 400 plus, you know, House bills sitting on his desk that he's done absolutely nothing with. We are in the you know, midst of the most trying pandemic and the third wave of the pandemic, where we've seen over 225,000 Americans die, many of those folks people of color. And to think that, you know, we're going to push through or ram through a Senate confirmation of a new justice as opposed to, you know, doing what people need, which is relief from COVID-19 and the pandemic yeah. and the economic impact. It's just ridiculous. And so the whole idea that people of color don't deserve representation or we should break up D.C. And move people here and there is pretty insulting to me personally as a person of color. And so I want us to look at it from an equity lens of why do we consistently say that people in D.C. Or people in Puerto Rico don't deserve the kind of representation that they do?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. The answer is because to grant them that representation would upset the foundations of prolonged minority rule.
Absolutely. Yeah. And think about yeah. places like Wyoming and states that, you know, have, you know, hardly any people in them that have two Senate representatives, right? It just doesn't make sense if we're thinking about it from an equity lens. And so I just want folks to really step back just a moment from kind of the banter that's been going on for the last 15, 20 years around this conversation and, you know, kind of open with fresh eyes and look at this from that perspective.
Certainly. I want to comment briefly on what BT said towards the beginning of his call, which was there's nothing in the Constitution that says the sitting president can't appoint and confirm a Supreme Court justice. You know, whenever that vacancy happens to occur, the president has a right to appoint and confirm a justice. Trump has that right now. Obama had that right 4 years ago, but it was at that point that it was stolen from him by Mitch McConnell. There was no basis for McConnell to make that choice. There's no basis for him to deny Obama that seat. And likewise, there's no constitutional reason to deny Trump the seat now. So the original sin in this situation remains McConnell. Which is why I think this political era is cast in his image more than anybody else's. And speaking of McConnell, have you noticed, like, this color of his skin is changing? His hands are like, have you noticed that?
Ooh,
it's just practicing the dark arts has exacted a horrible toll on him or something.
Just saying, the demon's coming out. It's showing itself. You know, I love horror movies and recently saw his hands and were like, oh my goodness, I wonder, you know, who did his makeup. Also Rudy Giuliani is looking quite ghostly and scary these days. But, you know, I just think, you know, you live in this world where you position yourself to do terrible things. There has to be a reckoning at some point. You know, I am not a religious person, but I am a spiritual person, and I think you cannot move through life doing terrible things and never have ever have to pay for that. I just don't know. I mean, I hope it's true, but
that's right. You'd like to think that a karmic wheel comes around, right? And if you're a horrible person, you will one day have a comeuppance. In Mitch McConnell's case, I really hope that happens. I want to take just a minute to talk about something I mentioned at the outset, which is this period of indecision after election night, this interregnum, if you will, this period of time where we don't really know who has won the election. There are a couple of very key dates in that period that we should all be paying attention to. There is a period, it's 79 days from the election to January 20th, where the Constitution says unequivocally that the new president shall take office. There's a couple other dates in there that are important. The first is the first Monday after the second Wednesday in December, which is the 14th of December this year, which is when the electors meet in all 50 states and the District of Columbia to cast their ballots for president. And then the third day of January, when Congress is seated, this is the newly elected Congress, and the sixth day of January, when the House and Senate meet jointly for a formal count of the electoral vote. So those are the key signposts, the key dates that we should be paying attention to if this thing turns into a protracted mess, which it may. So bear those things in mind. And if we do end up in this sort of situation, you can count on the fact that Tracy and I will keep you apprised of exactly what is happening and what is coming up on the horizon. So with that in mind, let's go back to the phones. Harry, good morning.
Oh, greetings, Abe and Tracy, and thank you for taking my call. We don't realize how well we have it with vote in mail. My daughter moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and the big change is she had to go through just to vote. Waiting in line for 3 hours. I mean, and especially if you have children, so her ex-husband has to watch the kids while she votes, and vice versa. You know, can't take kids with you to the voting booth. You know, and just all the shenanigans and all the vote stealing that's going on is just unbelievable. You know, purging votes and everything else. And she never had to deal with that. You know, on the West Coast, but on the East Coast, you have to deal with that. I also have a sister who lives in St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. All the five territories do not vote for president. There is no, they cannot vote for president if you're a resident of one of the of one of these territories. And in 2017, Puerto Rico voted to become a state, but they're going to
say, They had a really low turnout in that referendum.
Pardon me?
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I think I disagree with you with that one. But anyway, also what happened in 2017 was the storm. And Puerto Rico, believe it or not, had 5 million people. After the storm, 2 million people immigrated. Let's say immigrated because they're all U.S. citizens. They came to the regular states, and guess what? They can vote. What do you mean vote? Well, even though each territory has a representative, none of if the like when Baird was the head of the Congress, well, they can restrict them from voting. They can still have functions and be in committees or whatever, but they cannot vote. But when Pelosi won, well, Pelosi said, well, they all can vote. So they have an issue with taxation without representation. And why the Democrat Party doesn't hammer them with this and let the people know around the country that, you know, their voting rights and territories are really bad and shame. They can't even vote for president. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank
I mean, you. I'm right there, and I think, regardless of your political leaning views, if you had really good ideas, why wouldn't you want people to vote for them?
Right?
I just think there is a reckoning there that you don't have good ideas. You're not doing anything positive for actual people. So the only thing that you can do in that position it's to stop people from voting for other ideas that are better, that actually serve the public interest. And so for me, it's like, you know, at some point, there has to be, you know, work done within the party that is continually and persistently doing the voter suppression, the gerrymandering, the other ways in which they're trying to maintain that minority rule, where people start to question, why am I standing in line for 5 hours when I live in Wisconsin? Why? And Wisconsin is cold, I'll just tell you, I used to live there. Why is it so hard for me to vote and have my voice heard? That should be very troubling for people, from a place of just understanding how democracy works and understanding that, as one of our callers said today, if you are an individual in this world and in this country, the one way that you have to communicate your wishes and wills of the state is to vote, right? And people are actively taking that away from you. Why would you continue voting for those people?
I agree. It's the only way you can win an election is through vote suppression and disenfranchisement. That's not governance. That is rulership. You're not leading, you are ruling. And I think we need to start thinking of it in those terms. All of these steps that we've been talking about, disenfranchisement, gerrymandering, the 40-year plan to pack the federal judiciary with conservative judges. This is not just this is not gamesmanship that Mitch McConnell made up 4 years ago. This has been going on since the Reagan administration. All of these things taken together are an attempt to entrench minority rule. And what I mean is to make sure that white people are still in charge in about 30 or 40 years when white people no longer constitute a statistical majority in the United States. That's what this is about. And we need to resist that with every ounce of our strength.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely incompatible with life in a representative democracy, or the way life should be in a representative democracy. So let's go to Sean. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I think it's very extravagant to vote for either of the two major parties. Basically, what you're saying is that as Lucy has pulled away the football and Charlie Brown goes flying, the status quo of both parties saying one thing and then doing something else, you're basically signing on and saying, hey, I'm good with the status quo. You know, like, I'm comfortable enough. I'm not downwardly mobile, you know. I'm a member of the professional managerial class. You know, I think it's very extravagant to say, yes, the status quo of the last, 50 plus years, hey, I'm good. You know, this rate of change, this degree of political activity, I'm okay with it. I'm going to sign on, and I'm actually good with the status quo. So I just think it's very extravagant to, you know, to be in that position to say, hey.
Oh, yes. You know, yes. So indulgent for Corey to vote for the party who's not trying to kill people who look like him. So extravagant and indulgent. How dare he be so self-interested? What, dude, what are you talking about?
You mean the candidate that actually wrote the crime bill? That actually delivered us?
And he said it was a mistake.
I'm talking about one party backing the use of state violence against people of color and the other not. Now, I know that that's not a perfect declination between the two. No. But dude, what are you talking about right now?
You're upwardly mobile. I'm literally a yuppie.
The privilege that is dripping from your lips right now. Come on, man.
Managerial class, and I'm going to sign on with the author of Mass Incarceration. How nice that must be. How comfortable for them.
All right, well, what would you have Corey do? What is the answer?
Isn't it self-explanatory? Both major parties have been...
No, I'm asking you to explain it.
...pulling the rug out from under us for at least the last 50 years. So you can't keep going back to the same people and expecting different results. You've got to go third party. You've got to abandon both major parties.
And then, I'm not quite sure what you are encouraging people.
Oh, you're not quite sure of what I'm saying. I thought I was perfectly clear.
You were clear. We just think you're wrong.
We think you're wrong because it doesn't advance what's happening right now in this moment. And like I said earlier, voting is the front door. You don't just vote and then go back to your house and live your life. You vote and then you show up.
and then you say, this is what I want, and this is what we want. You organize, and you collaborate with other people who have the same views, and you press upon the people that you voted for to do what you want. You don't just vote and then step away. And I think that is what we've done for millennia, right? We've stepped into the space, we voted, and then we say, oh, take care of it now. That is a really lazy way of thinking about things. But right now, I am also a Black woman, and I have a Black partner, and I have Black nephews. And for me, I cannot possibly think about voting third party and not having my voice heard. It's not a thing. It's not possible at this moment.
Literally vote for the person who delivered mass incarceration to the United States.
Hey, thank you for the call. We are all well aware, I think I can safely speak for Tracy in this moment right now, that Joe Biden is far from satisfactory as a candidate. Would you agree with me, Tracy?
Yeah, not my first choice, second, third, but I'm voting.
No, not at all. I think we can all agree on that. But he is not a fascist. He is not cozy with white supremacists. He does not advance the cause of white nationalism. He does not treat undocumented people like animals, locking them in cages. He is not, I mean, I could go on. This is not a perfect situation. No one's trying to argue that it is. No one is saying that there's anything particularly virtuous about this dilemma that progressives find themselves in every 4 years. But it is what it is. If you want to talk about fourth party, the time is not 1 week before a national election. You need to build that third party continuously in the periods between national elections. I say this every 4 years, and it remains true. If you want a viable third party candidate, where are they? Where are they? They're not on the ballot.
There is not.
All right. That brings us to the end of our show. Tracy, thank you. Callers, thank you very much. Do you have anything you want to say in closing?
I will just say, do your civic duty. Get out there, vote. If you know people in these so-called, toss-up states, if you know people who are undecided, which I don't think they actually
You are just, tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Guess what? It's fall, so that means it's time for KBOO's annual membership meeting. Join us Saturday, November 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. via Zoom to hear updates about the station, meet candidates running for 4 open board seats,